candidates for the May 9 polls begin officially wooing voters. We'll get updates from correspondents on the ground. Partido Reforma's Pantaleon Alvarez clarifies only their Davao del Norte chapter has shifted support to Vice President Lenny Robredo. Will tackle the latest developments in the 2022 race with political science professor Edmond Dayo, and will also discuss the latest surveys with UP School of Statistics Associate Professor Francisco de los Reyes. And U.S. President Joe Biden officially calls on the G20 to kick out Russia. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Thanks for joining us. For those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, glad you could join us today. Topping the news at this hour, the campaign period for local positions in the 2022 polls is underway. There are 18,023 local posts up for grabs. 845 candidates are running unopposed. The Commission on Elections reminds candidates to strictly follow health measures amid fears campaign rallies could turn into super spreader events. Let's head on over now to Pasig City for a closer look at how the local race there is shaping up. Our very own Katrina Domingo now joins us from there with an update. Kat, go ahead.
Hi, Carmino. What was supposed to be an hour-long simple event in the Pasig Mega Market stretched out to become a star-studded party as Pasig City Mayor Vico Soto relaunched his campaign rally or his re-election bid for another mayoralty term here in the city. Among those who attended that rally are Soto's parents, celebrities Vic Soto and Connie Reyes, as well as actress Angelou De Leon and former television host Kiko Ruscia, who are now running for city councilor under Soto's slate. Carmina, the event earlier is a stark contrast when compared to Soto's 2019 campaign rally, where he was forced to hold his event at a dank area in Pasig with only a spotlight and a makeshift stage as his platform in airing his sentiments against then incumbent Mayor Bobby Eusebio. This time, Carmina, Soto is urging voters to give him another 3 years so that he can continue the gains of his administrations. Among this is the 100 billion annual savings of Pasig City thanks to anti-corruption efforts by the current administration. Soto says allowing him to have a full slate this year would also enable him or empower his administration to push for more reforms in the city. And do Carmina, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Carmina.
Go ahead.
Okay, as I was saying, Carmina, Soto's event earlier is a stark contrast compared to his 2019 event when he was still running against the Eusebio dynasty who ruled the city for about 27 years. Carmina, earlier, Soto urged Pasigueño voters to give him another 3 years so that he can further push for more reforms in the city. Among this, his five big-ticket projects, such as more government transparency, anti-corruption efforts, housing for indigent families, the universal health care, as well as improving education or free education here in the city. On the other hand, Carmina, his rival for the mayoralty post in the city, Vice Mayor Io Caruncho, started the day going through a house-to-house campaign in downtown Pasig, and he is expected to hold a campaign rally in Barangay San Joaquin later this afternoon. Carmina, it is important for our viewers to note that the local campaign period in Pasig it was held a week after Bernardo filed cyber libel charges against Soto. The vice mayor alleges that Soto intentionally besmirched his reputation during a January flag ceremony, where Soto called out his vice mayor for allegedly not attending several meetings and not fulfilling his functions as his second in command. So far, Carmina, Soto is back here at the City Hall, which is right behind me. He's back at work, and while his council hopefuls are out and about in the city campaigning, wooing voters to give them a chance to serve here in the Philippines' eighth most vote-rich city. Hermina.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you having or coming to the show and reporting to us. Katrina Dominga there joining us live from the city of Pasig. Take care, Kat. You keep safe. And from there, over in Marikina now, some local candidates kick off their campaigns by conducting house-to-house visits. Let's get more details now from our correspondent, Vivian Guglia. Viv, over to you.
Hi, Carmina. Local candidates in Marikina City kept the mood festive as the local campaign period kicks off. The sound of drums and campaign jingles filled the streets of Barangay Kalumpang as early as 8 a.m. today. Dozens of supporters clad in their best campaign color also went around putting up posters and handing out leaflets. Mayoral candidate and Marikina First District Representative Bayani Fernando led his party's house-to-house campaign in Kalumpang, taking the time to talk to residents and ask about issues they want resolved by the local government. Fernando, who was Marikina mayor from 1992 to 2001, says should he reclaim his old post, he will prioritize projects to mitigate flooding in the city, hire more doctors so each barangay health center will have one, and improve the public market. Fernando is going up against former ally and incumbent mayor Marcelino Teodoro. The rift sparked after the Marikina local government, headed by Teodoro, previously filed a complaint before the DENR against a reclamation project along a portion of Marikina River, supposedly by the firm of Fernando. Teodoro said it contributed to the massive flooding in the city during the onslaught of Typhoon Ulysses. But Fernando denies he is connected with the project, saying it is under the DPWH. Teodoro is scheduled to hold a house-to-house campaign in Barangay Malanday this afternoon. Should he be re-elected for a third term, Teodoro vows to further improve the city's healthcare infrastructure to institutionalize programs against COVID and adding medical personnel. He also plans to focus on economic recovery, continuing the tax incentives for new investors, rehabilitate the public market, and provide mentoring to MSMEs as well as access to low-interest loans. Early this morning, Commission on Elections Marikina held a mass attended by some local candidates, followed by a unity walk and peace covenant signing. Carmina, back to you.
Thanks a lot, Viv. Take care. Keep safe. Back here in the newsroom, the president of Partido Reforma clarifies only the Davao del Norte chapter of the party will be shifting their support from presidential candidate Senator Panfilo Lacson to Vice President Lenny Robredo. But given their ties to the leaders in other provinces in the region, Davao del Norte representative Pantaleon Alvarez is confident they can still deliver a large number of votes for Robredo.
Kasama ko yung aking gobernador, no? At yung mga kaalyado dito. Tumatawag din sa mga kaibigan namin sa ibang probinsya. Kung pwede, ay samahan kami sa pagsuporta kay VP Lenny Robredo. Kung makukumbinsi natin na sumama sa pagsuporta kay VP Lenny, eh malaki-laki po yun. Kung 1 million lang, kayang-kaya yun.
Alvarez also cited his fears of another Marcos presidency for their group's decision to switch to Robredo.
Karamihan ano yung mga kabataan na hindi nila alam kung gaano kalupit yung dekada 80, yung panahon ni Ferdinand Marcos. Yung constitution naman, kung talagang magaling yung namumuno, pwede pa rin lusutan yan. Yung constitution natin ngayon, yung mga safeguards, kung talagang yung presidente mo gustuhin, wala tayong magagawa dyan.
The endorsement of Partido Reforma not only provides a huge boost to the campaign of Vice President Robredo, her spokesperson, Barry Gutierrez, says the support also conveys a strong message that people with disagreements can still find common ground and work together. He explains Robredo's campaign is all about welcoming people from different backgrounds based on shared principles.
It's very, very helpful. And I think that the vice president was very, very clear on that yesterday in their press conference. Because aside from the sheer support in terms of the party's numbers, in terms of the leaders that will now be campaigning for the vice president, there is a huge symbolic value to the support from for Partido Reforma. As mentioned by Congressman Alvarez earlier, he and VP Robredo have not always had a good relationship. They have been on opposite sides of the political fence at one point, but now they are together, and that's a very, very strong symbol that people who may have had disagreements before.
Let's get another update now on the local campaigns here in Metro Manila. Our correspondent, Zien Ambrosio, tells us about the mayoral race, this time in Quezon City. Zien, over to you.
Carmina, on the first day of local campaign here in Quezon City, in preparation for the May 2022 election, where people say that there will be a stiff competition in the city, incumbent Quezon City Mayor Joy Belmonte under the Servicio sa Bayan Party is running for her second term with incumbent Vice Mayor Gian Soto. Belmonte's most known contender for the post in the upcoming election is Congressman Mike Defensor, the incumbent Anak Kalusugan Party List representative. The program of Servicio sa Bayan Party started with a mass at 6 a.m. at the Quezon Memorial Circle with a big crowd. Well, the program of Malayan QC also started with a mass at 11 a.m. at District 3, but mainly with the candidates and their relatives. Belmonte and Defensor are both from prominent families. Mayor Joy is the daughter of former House Speaker Sonny Belmonte, while Congressman Mike Defensor is the niece of Senator Miriam Defensor Santiago, former Senator Miriam Defensor Santiago. The platform of Belmonte includes housing, where the land will be awarded to its beneficiaries. Well, Defensor's platform, on the other hand, includes education, where he plans to strengthen the Wi-Fi in the city and uplift the education system and at the same time gain more investors in the business sector. Mayor Belmonte says her 14-point agenda for the city will not be accomplished in one term, and she will continue it if she wins for a second term. Defensor, meantime, reiterates that he will bring change to the city. Other candidates with Defensor are from prominent families, including the Castellos and the Crisologos. Meantime, running with Mayor Belmonte's Servicio sa Bayan Party is known actor Arjo Ataide, who is running for congressman in District 1, and Ralph Tulfo, son of famous broadcast journalist and senatorial candidate Rafi Tulfo. Aside from Defensor and Belmonte, there are seven more candidates running for mayor in Quezon City: Rick Bello of PDSP, Partido Democratico Socialista ng Pilipinas, Jose Ingles of WPP or Workers and Peasants Party, plus five more independent candidates. And that's the latest here in Quezon City. Zien Ambrosio, ABS-CBN News.
Thanks a lot, Zien. Take care. Keep safe. Back here in the newsroom, the camp of Vice President Leni Robredo reasserts it will not drop its support for her running mate, Senator Kiko Pangilinan, despite calls for them to do so.
We understand that there will be groups, there will be parties, there will be local officials who will choose to have some other configuration. And you know, we respect them. That's the thing with our system. The president and the vice president are not elected in tandem. But insofar as the vice president and insofar as the campaign is concerned, our vice presidential bet is Senator Kiko Pangilinan. And we will be doing everything we can in the next 45 days to ensure that he, who has been chosen by the vice president as her preferred partner in governance, will be elected as VP come May.
Meanwhile, Albay Representative Joey Salceda sees more local officials going for a Robredo-Duterte tandem.
There are at least 17 provinces where they both won. I mean, Duterte and VP Leni, Agusan del Norte, Nidagat, Southern Leyte, Cebu, Bohol, Lano del Norte, Lano del Sur, Misamis Oriental, Bukidnon, Maguindanao, Tawi-Tawi, Basilan, Batangas, Zamboanga, Sibugay, Zamboanga City, Lapu-Lapu City. That's 11 million voters. Mm-hmm. So right now we have about 7 or openly declared, but I know of at least 20, additional 20, who will soon come out for Leni's hour.
Could President Duterte be on the verge of declaring Ferdinand Marcos Jr. as his chosen successor? Well, that's the question being raised after the chief executive met with Marcos last Sunday. Presidential spokesperson Martin Andanara and Senator Bongo said Duterte has yet to confirm if he will support Marcos's candidacy. Duterte had previously called Marcos a weak leader. The meeting was held for 3 days, or make that 3 days, before Duterte's PDP Laban Party endorsed Marcos's presidential bid. A former Supreme Court justice believes Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is gunning for the presidency to avoid paying hundreds of billions of pesos in estate tax liabilities. Let's hear more from Warren de Guzman.
The Supreme Court ruled the over 23 billion peso estate tax assessment on the Marcos family as final and executory in 1997, with the annual penalty on the non-payment of estate taxes set at a hefty 20%. That assessment ballooned to over 203 billion. Former Supreme Court Justice Antonio Carpio believes Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the administrator of the Marcos estate alongside his mother Imelda Marcos, may have decided to run for president to avoid paying that tax liability.
Marcoses have developed a counter strategy. They will make the right to collect of the government prescribe. Once he is in president, nobody will file a notice demand letter on him. And he has a term of 6 years. And it takes only 5 years for the prescriptive period to set in. So that is their counter strategy. So he becomes president, I'm certain that 203 billion will be gone forever.
Each crime has a prescription period wherein the victim or the government must act. Otherwise, they lose their right to bring the offender to justice. Carpio says as long as the government sends demand letters to Marcos, the prescription period of 5 years to collect the estate tax will always reset. As president, Marcos can order the BIR not to send the letter. Former BIR Commissioner Kim Inara says the Bureau of Internal Revenue should file a criminal case against Marcos to collect, and Carpio agrees.
If you are legally obliged to pay the tax and you willfully refuse to pay the tax, you are criminally liable, up to 10 years imprisonment. And that's why I'm saying the BIR, if it wants to now, it can file a criminal case. And I think it's time because 25 years almost. Almost a quarter of a century, they have not paid the tax. Ano pang iniintay ng BIR?
The law provides such a remedy. But I just like to point out that if BBM becomes president, I think for 6 years, because of the presidential immunity, you might not be able to file a criminal case.
Carpio and Henares aren't the only ones pushing for the BIR to file a criminal case against Marcos Jr. The Alliance of Women for Action Towards Reform, or AWARE, posted a petition to this end on March 20th. Since then, it has garnered over 18,000 signatures.
We'll try our best to put pressure on BIR, Commissioner Dulay, and the other commissioners to act on this petition that they file a criminal case against Marcos. And if not, it is a pressure point. It's an election issue campaign.
I don't know why BIR has to be pressured by all these signatures. It's the law.
ABS-CBN is still trying to get a reaction from Marcos Jr. and the BIR. AWARE and Justice Carpio support the presidential bid of Vice President Lenny Robredo. Commissioner Henares supports the presidential bid of Senator Ping Lacson. Warren de Guzman, ABS-CBN News.
Well, joining us now to talk about the 2022 local races as well as the developments in the race for Malacañang is political science professor Edmund Tayo. He is executive director of the Local Government Development Foundation. Professor Tayo, nice to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us today. Good afternoon to you.
Thanks for having me, Carmina. Good afternoon to all our viewers.
All right, so we're going to go national first, then go local. I want to talk about what happened yesterday.
Unusual. I don't even call our political setup a political system anymore. Everything has become really out and out, just dependent on personalities. And as it is shown now with the recent decision of Partido Reforma, which is, of course, led by no less than former House Speaker Pantaleon Alvarez, already suggests that, of course, there are some considerations which may not be shared within the original membership of the party, which included Senator Ping Lacson running for president. So I don't know exactly what their parameters or I don't know calculations or algorithms are in considering changing support from one candidate to another. But at the end of the day, again, it's not unusual, considering that everything depends on personalities.
Well, we heard it from the spokesperson of the vice president himself. Attorney Barry Gutierrez said that it's a welcome boost. It's symbolic also in a way. They found themselves on opposite sides on certain issues before, but now they have a common goal. But what do you think about this shifting of allegiances? Will it really amount, or is it really a welcome boost to the campaign of the vice president, or is it a kiss of death?
I think it may add up to the campaign of the vice president. No, if I remember it right, I think I've chanced upon the statement of the former speaker, mm-hmm. Suggesting that from where they sit, that there's a noticeable support, increase in the support of the vice president's bid. No? So perhaps that has been their main consideration, no, for switching support. Mm. Now, as to the shared programs, I think when the former Speaker Alvarez was unseated as Speaker, that has also shown some differences with the administration. So perhaps that's what they were referring to as some shared principles. But I caught some of the interview before my line was cut earlier, that the camp of Vice President Lenny saying that still they're going to support the vice presidency of Senator Kiko Pangilinan. So again, that goes to show that the idea of shared programs and shared policies is secondary only, if at all it is really a factor in determining a party's or a group's support to a particular candidate. The main consideration really is the personality.
And because you said that, I mean, we all know that part of the campaign of the vice president, the vice president's campaign is, to change the system. But can people really expect that of her, considering the endorsements after endorsements after endorsements that she's been getting from people in past administrations? That sort of also solidifies the belief of some that these were the people who failed to fulfill their promises to the people. I mean, take, for example, former Speaker Pantaleon Alvarez. Some consider him as a traditional politician. How can the vice president now fight the system and strive for changes in the system when these are the very same people who are backing her now? Professor.
Alam mo, Carmina, again, no, if I may emphasize, it's about personalities. So regardless whether you're dealing with Pedro or Juan, who originally was not with you before, only goes to show that anything is possible under the current setup, precisely kasi, when we speak of politics, it's supposed to be akin to or related to or towards the adoption of particular policies and programs. Pero dito sa atin, it's not like that. It's just partisan politics, kampihan sa Tagalog. Mm-hmm. No? So, regardless as to who you are working with, at the end of the day, you are actually choosing only among the same group of choices. Kasi even those who are really qualified to run for office, and we're seeing this with some of the presidential candidates who don't only have the popular name, but also don't have the resources. But quite obviously, in some of the debates, they've shown equal capacity, if not a better capacity than leading candidates. No, but they're not rating precisely again because there's no political parties and so on. I'm glad to hear that the vice president is considering system change, but. I have yet to hear from any of the candidates really categorically saying that, they're endorsing or they're going to pursue real systemic change if elected to office. But I'm glad to hear that.
When you talk about the local race, though, Professor Tayao, that's a whole different ballgame altogether. I know that this has been your advocacy from day one. And with the Mandanas ruling coming into play after the 2022 elections, I mean, what is really at stake here when you look at the local races?
I'm glad you're asking that, Carmina. In fact, I'm going to plug it now. I'm starting a webinar to popularize the Mandanas-Garcia ruling starting Saturday next week, working with voting young voters, with civil society, and local government units themselves. No? Because, the Mandanas-Garcia ruling is not only going to result to increased resources in LGUs, but also a change in the budgeting and even the planning process, both at the national and local level. Mm. You know, the change in the computation of local shares in the overall revenue of the national government would have to result to local government units working together so that they can identify commonly shared expenses and projects. Now, why? Because, initiatives at the local level, don't cut across political boundaries. Hindi katulad sa national yan that when you do a budgeting for roads, for example, madali mong ilagay sa budget precisely because it's all national.
But Professor, when you go local, that's assuming that the local chief executive that will win in the 2022 elections in any particular area really has the heart for the people and really has the heart for developing their area. The fear here
That's
as well is that... Yeah, the fear here as well is that there's a whole lot of money we're talking about here, Professor. Go ahead.
That's why I was trying to explain, Carmina, before you cut me off, they can no longer, it's not going to work anymore that LGUs will do their own planning without any link to the next level of government. As it is right now, when we do planning, it's always kanya-kanya.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very fragmented local government system. I've been working on it for more than a decade now, and that's the main limitation. And the Mandanas-Garcia ruling opens up opportunities so that there is a way to, pool resources together and collaborate in so many shared areas of concern.
And when you talk about the areas of concern, what do you think? I mean, if we're all after greater development here, the expansion of development to the countryside most especially, what are these concerns that must be there? What should be the focus of all these local chief executives that will be elected come May 9, 2022, Professor?
You know, Carmina, if I go back in time before decentralization, that means before the 1991 local government code, there was really not much development that we can remember as far as the countryside is concerned. Only select key cities, shared some level of development for obvious reasons. Now, when that decentralization happened, it did not necessarily result to development after 5 years. It's after about 10 years. Again, there were so many studies that reveal that. And in other words, the Mandanas-Garcia ruling is an add-on to this policy development. And that shared objective can only happen now more so because, again, the effectiveness of the approach of every LGU can be harnessed only when they work together. In other words, they will be forced to work together. It's not a question of culture. It's not a question of behavior. It's a question of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this last year, for example. We've been very busy trying to figure out the best way to roll out the Mandanas-Garcia ruling. Now, it's quite technical, really. I hope that there will be more time for a TV program to explain it. But as I was saying, if it's a question of corruption, it's not something that we can undo or resolve overnight. No, but the more important question really is that there's more opportunity to, do more, not only for LGUs, but also for different stakeholders to work together.
And the important thing here is, Professor Tayao, another important factor here is that when you talk about the Mandanas-Garcia ruling, we're not just talking about the local chief executives here. We've got to talk about the constituents, and they have to know that this is at play, and they have to know that this is going to be enforced so that they know what they should expect from the local chief executives after the elections. Go ahead, Professor.
Kaya nga, there's a need to popularize it. No? Hindi masyado napag-uusapan. In fact, it's not only at the local level, even at the national level. That's why at the outset, I said that it is going to change the budgeting and the planning system. Mm-hmm. It is best really, and I couldn't agree more, that the constituents should really engage their local officials. But at the end of the day, it's not only the local officials which should be doing a lot of work. Kasi to be fair, and again, I've sat in the series of activities that led to the issuance of the EO. There's so much to be had as far as not only the capacity but even the willingness of the national government to work with the LGUs. You see, at the end of the day, it's a question of really whether the national government practically the national government agencies see the LGUs as competent institutions. And if they don't see the LGUs as competent institutions, what can be done to make them competent institutions? Mm-hmm. Now, just to briefly give the viewers an idea, again, if I may emphasize, after decentralization happened in 1991, there is so much development that happened in the countryside. No? So, in other words, that goes to show that local officials have not only learned so much, but I'm inclined to think have become more competent than ever. Kahit itong pandemic na lang, if you remember, at the outset, they were really engaging the national government that they can, in fact, use their own resources to fund their own tracking, testing, and health necessities. But it was the national government that rejected it. Mm-hmm. No? So at the end of the day, the centralist thinking should really change, no? Mm-hmm. As far as governance is concerned. And that can really result to so much that we've been wanting to have.
In fact, when you think about it, Professor Tayao, you could look at this pandemic as sort of a dress rehearsal for these local government units and what they can
that's
do.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Kung pinoyanan lang sana nila, nung umpisa pa lang.
That's another topic altogether, Professor. But I do want to talk to you about the 845 candidates who are running unopposed in the local race. What do you think about that? How do you think this is going to affect development?
Again, it's part of the whole setup, Carmina. Kasi nga, wala naman tayong tunay na political party. Everything is dependent on personality. So if you are, for example, even if you are prepared, you're competent, you have the right background to run for office, if you don't have the resources, if you don't have the name, then you'll think twice running for office. Hence, what's happening now is that more and more have become hesitant, no? In throwing their hat in the political ring. So until such time that we're able to change the rules of the game, we will have more of the same. And, I hope not. No, we'll probably have baka mas sumama pa, no? The kind of politics that we're seeing now might get worse if we continue to operate under the current setup.
Okay, and that's another topic altogether. Of course, you're talking about the shift to another form of political system. We're going to talk about that as the months go by. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank you for always keeping your line open for us. Thanks a lot to Professor Edmund Tayao, Executive Director of the Local Government Development Foundation, right there. And from there, we're going to take a break. Up ahead, U.S. President Joe Biden calls for Russia's expulsion from the G20. Details of that story and more when Dateline Philippines returns. Stay with us here on ANC. And we are back. You're still with Dateline Philippines here on ANC. U.S. President Joe Biden officially calls for Russia's expulsion from the G20. This follows a day of intense global diplomacy in Brussels as world leaders gather to discuss further sanctions against Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. Biden says if other nations do not support Russia's ouster from the G20, Ukraine should be able to participate in their meetings. One wild card in America's efforts to pressure Russia economically is China.
I had a very straightforward conversation with Xi now, I guess it's 6 days ago, 7 days ago in that range. And I made it clear to him, I made no threats, but I made it clear to him that make sure he understood the consequences of him helping Russia. China understands that its economic future is much more closely tied to the West than it is to Russia. And so I'm hopeful that he does not get engaged.
Biden is headed to Poland next to witness firsthand the plight of refugees who fled the war. Poland houses the most Ukrainian refugees. It has taken in more than 2.1 million since the invasion began. The U.S. and its allies also discussed possible further coordinated release of oil to help calm markets in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Some countries also said they would not comply with Moscow's demand to buy Russian oil and gas using rubles.
We all, I think almost everyone spoke in this last session, and everyone was united in condemning, obviously, Vladimir Putin's war, but also united in seeing how we can do what we can to both increase supply, adopt efficiency measures, but also this transition to clean and how we can accelerate it as fast as we possibly can. And then just with respect to the emergency stockpiles, I think these are ongoing discussions and all those tools are certainly on the table.
Global oil prices fell on Thursday on news of the possible coordinated oil release. Benchmark Brent crude fell to $119 from above $120 before the summit in Brussels. The U.S. West Texas Intermediate also settled lower at $112 per barrel. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky asserts his country should be in the European Union in the near future. In his video address to the regional bloc, Zelensky thanked the EU for imposing sweeping sanctions against Russia in response to its invasion. But he says these steps, although strong, were a little too late.
Because if it had been preventive, Russia would not start a war. There was a chance. You blocked Nord Stream 2. But it was also a little late. Because if it were on time, Russia would not have created a gas crisis. At least, there was such a chance. Now you and I are preparing Ukraine's membership in the European Union. Finally, here I am asking you not to be late. Please, because during this month, you have compared these worlds and you see everything. You saw who is worth what, and you saw that Ukraine should be in the EU in the near future.
In the days following the beginning of the invasion, Ukraine officially applied for EU membership and asked for immediate approval. But the regional bloc said it would not rush the application process. Mayoral candidates in Cebu City visit communities on day one of the official local campaign period. Let's get more details now from our correspondent, Annie Perez. Annie?
Yes, Hermina. All three candidates here in Cebu City for the mayoralty position all started their local campaign at respective parishes to ask for blessing before they proceeded to meet with their supporters as they kicked off the start of the local campaign period today. This is the first time that the city will have a three-pronged mayoralty race. That's why it's interesting to note that there are three candidates now vying for the position. For Partido Barug, which is headed by the incumbent Mayor Michael Rama, they filled the Cebu Metropolitan Cathedral during the mass and distributed t-shirts outside. They then trotted the streets of the city and went to the Cebu City Hall, where they were accompanied by a band, and Mayor Rama made rounds to different offices, shaking the hands of employees and the clients who were in the City Hall. He's been a seasoned politician for more than 20 years now, and he said he will continue the 10-point agenda that he and former Mayor Edgar Labelle already passed on, started during 2019. Rama is also under PDP Laban, and he already formally endorsed Ferdinand Marcos Jr. as their presidential bet. The Bando Osmeña Pundo Kauswagan, on the other hand, which is run by the Osmeña family, has Margot Osmeña, which is the wife of former Cebu City Mayor Tomas Osmeña, as their standard bearer. They had a Thanksgiving Mass as well at the Guadalupe Church, where supporters were waiting for them outside holding placards. BOPK, with its long history with the Osmeña family, has ties already with the Liberal Party and therefore has also endorsed Vice President Lenny Robredo as their presidential bet. Meanwhile, the third candidate in this three-pronged race is independent candidate Councillor Dave Tumulak, who also sought his supporters to join him in a Thanksgiving Mass at the Holy Cross Parish Church. Tumulak is an incumbent councillor who has served for three terms and also served the public prior to his stint in the government as a former radio and TV personality. He gave out masks with his name on it to his supporters, and he also said that he thanks his supporters that despite his lack in machinery, he will continue to campaign for his advocacy and is hoping that the people will see his track record and what he has done in the city for the past 9 years. Now, despite all these happenings in the city, Carmina, the Cebu City Police Office has made sure that the three kickoff this morning, today, has been duly secured, and they have made sure that all the health protocols have been implemented, noting that only the Cebu City is the city in the whole island that has in under alert level 1 because of the COVID-19 cases. Cebu City is the most populated area in the whole of Cebu Island. It currently has 733,000 registered voters for the May 2022 polls, and it's important that whoever is the presidential bet that the mayoralty candidate will endorse will also get their security of votes, because it's one-third of the island's population and a big chunk of the voting bloc. And we also have to take note that Cebu is the most vote-rich province in the country with over 3.2 million voters. And that's the latest here in Cebu, Carmina.
Thanks a lot, Annie. Take care and keep safe. The campaign of local candidates in the province of Cavite also in full swing. Our correspondent Michael DeLiso now on the line with an update. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, Carmina. Candidates here in Cavite Province, south of Manila, kicked off their respective campaigns today. As a prelude, most of the candidates begin with a mass in their localities in the morning with their teams, and followed by motorcades, unity walks, and house-to-house visits. Many people came out to show support to their candidates with COVID-19 health protocols already disregarded. In night town re-election, is Cavite Governor John Vicremulla and running mate Atsina Tolentino attended a mass, along with members of National Unity Party in the town, including brothers Rafi and Jun Dualan, who are running for mayor and vice mayor, respectively. In Silang Town, mayoral candidate Omil Poblete and her team held a unity walk amid scorching heat. In an interview with media, Rimulla said political families in the province are united, as some of them have no opponent.
The political families are actually one. Wala na kami dito. Wala nang laban-laban dito. Nag-aisa na kami. Layunin namin para sa Cavite. Nagkasundo na kami. Kaya dito talaga peaceful ng election sa Cavite.
Is it an advantage or disadvantage po ba yun para sa mga botante naman?
Advantage, because with peace comes a lot of prosperity.
Among political families in Cavite are Darimulias, Pobletes in Silang, Dualans in Naik, Revillas in Bacoor, Chuas in Noveleta and Cavite City, Tolentinos in Tagaytay, Barzagas in Dasmariñas, Ferrers in General Trias, among others. Candidates say it is challenging to hold campaigns during this pandemic.
Kanina nahirapan ako. Hindi ko alam paano yun. Siyempre may mga pupunta lalapit para makipag-fistbump, makipag-selfie. So hindi ko alam kung ano talaga paano. Kasi sa guidelines, bawal ang mga ganito.
Siyempre hamon talaga yun. Dahil first time mangyari ito sa bayan na
ito. At least 633 individuals who filed their respective certificate of candidacies are vying for 268 elective positions here in Cavite. Later tonight, several concerts will be held during proclamation events such as River Maya in Imus City and Parokya ni Edgar in Alfonso Town. That's the latest here in Cavite. Back to you, Ramina.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Take care. Keep safe. And let's now get an update on the campaign activities of local candidates in Cotabato City. Our correspondent Lirio Bumpat now on the line to tell us more. Lirio, go ahead.
Yes, Carmina, candidates in Cotabato City sparked the local campaign through a motorcade and proclamation rally. Incumbent Mayor Cynthia Gani Sayani is seeking re-election with her party mate, incumbent Vice Mayor Graham Zerdumama, under the Nationalist People's Coalition. The incumbent mayor is being challenged by former Councillor Bruce Matabalaw, running under the MILF's United Bangsamoro Justice Party, or UBJP. Incumbent Councillor Butch Abu, the son of the late MILF Vice Chair for Political Affairs, Ghazali Jafar, seeks the vice mayoral post under the UBJP. Two candidates are vying for the mayor's post in the city. Three are running in the vice mayoral race and 12 are running for councilor. Meantime, Police Regional Office, DARMM, has formed two regional special operations task groups days before the local campaign starts. PNP BARM Regional Director, Police Brigadier General Arthur Cabalona said one RSOTG will focus in Cotabato City and Maguindanao and one for Lanao del Sur. Cabalona said these RSOTGs would focus on election concerns as part of PNP BARM security preparation for the upcoming May 9, 2022 election. PNP BARM has identified towns in Maguindanao and in Lanao del Sur as election areas of concern, while there are also barangays in Cotabato City categorized as areas of concern. Lirio Bombas, ABS-CBN News, Cotabato City.
Thanks again, Lirio. Take care and keep safe. And joining us now to help us dive deeper into the latest pre-election surveys is Professor Francisco Kiko de los Reyes. He is Associate Professor at the UP School of Statistics. Professor, truth be told, I've been wanting to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right. So first of all these pre-election surveys, a lot of people have a lot of opinion about them. But what should the public understand about all these surveys that are coming out?
Well, the public should know that the surveys are done in one point in time. It's a point in time snapshot of what's happening right now, here and now. Hindi ito nakataga sa bato. It is not cast in stone. You do not expect that what you see now is the one that will happen on election day. That's a very important message that everyone must understand.
But then you have other people who are juxtaposing survey after survey after survey, sort of presenting the public with sort of a trend. Is that how the people should see it? And if it's so consistent, then would that amount to the same picture come election day after the votes are cast?
Yeah. Our campaign in the Philippines is very dynamic. Things unfold. Kagabi lang, di ba? There is an event that happened. So each day passes, there is an anticipated new thing happening. So there could be certain turning points that may happen in the next 45 days, and this would trigger changes in the percentages. Remember that when the survey was done, the question posed was, if the elections were done today, no? Ngayon gagawin ng eleksyon. So we must be open to the idea that many things can unfold in the future leading to the election day.
I have a question for you, Professor. Can these surveys be manipulated?
It now boils down to core values. These professional organizations, they are bound by international guidelines on disclosure. There must always be full disclosure. They must always tell the sample sizes, how they allocated their sample, what are the events that surrounded the survey gathering, the data gathering. Mm-hmm. There is a comprehensive document that must be satisfied, no? for them to publish this report. So I hope that all our organizations doing this at the national scale, or even in the smaller scale, even in the local scale, should adhere to this. That's the only thing that will give them credibility. It's track plus adherence to these standards.
But do you feel, having all these survey results come out in the past couple of months or so, do you have any question about their credibility, or do you find them credible?
Yeah, I have issues because these companies should explain certain things, like how come there was this issue just last week, Yata, that certain social democratic areas or social demographic classes were not represented. If our target population is the population of registered voters, then even if they're small, they should also be represented. Mm. So this issue of representation. No? So I think if we do not include these kinds of standards, the credibility gets eroded. So that's for me a very important thing.
There's also a concern that these survey results are being put out to condition the minds of the people. Is that a concern of yours as well?
Yes, it's a very valid concern. Actually, the School of Statistics issued a statement regarding these surveys, you know, because many of them have questionable methodologies. And they put their results side by side, and then they string together a conclusion while all their methodologies are questionable. Mm-hmm. So we're calling the public to demand accountability from these companies. We should at least get information. They should disclose to us certain basic things for them to legitimize their published results. Yesterday, there was an event at the School of Statistics. We discussed this together with experts in the Marketing and Opinion Research Society mm-hmm. of the Philippines. And we agreed that this should be demanded by the public. We should not receive results right away. We should always question whatever method they employed in their surveys.
But is it that, Professor? Is it also because you don't like what the surveys are showing you?
For trained statisticians, whether we want it or not, whether it agrees to our personal belief, we have to stand by our results if we believe that the methodology is correct. So magalit na magalit, matuwa nang matuwa, we will stand by our statistics if we did the proper methodology. Mm. So there are surveys moving around which we are not really confident. A very important example is Calye survey. These are very biased kinds of data collection. Pumunta ka lang sa kumpulan and then you got responses. Naghahabol ka pa sa palengke. These are not examples of bias preselection.
Mm. All right. So when you talk about surveys, we're not just only talking about the surveys that are being put out there. There are also so-called internal surveys, right?
Yes.
That the candidates and the campaigns themselves employ to get them a snapshot of what is really happening on the ground. But when you talk about that, are you confident that these surveys, the internal surveys that are being done, really present them the real picture? Or do these internal surveys just indulge the candidate and just present them what they want to hear?
Yeah. We have a network of alumni at the school who tell us that there are certain organizations who really adhere to the standards, even if they are doing an internal survey. But there are fly-by-night organizations that do this just to indulge, really.
Hmm. Oh, and you stop and, right there.
Yes. because we do not see them as legitimate data-gathering institutions. Hmm. These organizations that we say are legitimate are those who pose neutrality, those who use international standards, adhere to international standards in data gathering and reporting. Now, if, for example, now in our statement, we said that there are PR firms who do their data gathering. What do you expect from that? Mm-hmm. Right? Because they have clients and they do the data gathering. What do you expect from that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there is some erosion in the confidence. Remember that trust in these surveys are earned. No, you do not impose, magaling kami, malaki kami, we have principals abroad. We do not care about that. What we care about is, were you doing the right thing in terms of the scientific method in data gathering?
Mm.
So we do have reports that there are certain fly-by-night organizations that do this and then post the results online.
You know how survey results are put out, right? And of course, yes, people begin to read them. And when the public reads them without the scientific knowledge that should go into it, the tendency is to believe or to just dismiss it because it doesn't agree with what they think, right? But as you have been pointing out, surveys have to be in a vacuum, so to speak. It has to be sort of presented without any of the biases. As you said, it's a snapshot of what is happening at that point in time. So having said that, and you talk about trust as well, what do you tell the public now if they're presented with these surveys? What should be their guiding principles as they look at these numbers?
First, you have to look for how big the sample was, right? So if it's sufficient enough, like 1,200 to 1,400, that's okay. Mm. And then they tell you what was the allocation. They got it from, let's say, National Capital Region, the rest of Luzon. They got it from Visayas, from Mindanao. Was there urban-rural representation? Were genders represented? Were socioeconomic classification represented? Was education represented? Age groups represented? And if that transparency is present, that's a good thing. Another thing is the way it is communicated. If it's charged with emotional words, like nilampaso ni ganito, so you use these words to frame the conclusion of the survey, that's a red flag. And for me, for a regular person not knowledgeable in the scientific method of data gathering, these are the things that that person can use to critically assess if a survey result is legitimate. So it's more of the basics, the numbers that you are seeing, the surrounding events should be disclosed. Mm. Given the lockdowns, you cannot really penetrate all the barangays or all the sampled barangays. That in itself constrains the random sampling. Mm. And more important is the communication. How was it communicated for public consumption?
And we're going to have to leave it at that because we've just run out of time. Professor Francisco Kiko de los Reyes, Associate Professor at the UP School of Statistics. A pleasure talking to you. I wish we had more time, but I'm sure we're going to talk to you in the next couple of days again. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Maraming salamat, Carmina.
And before we go, next week on In Focus, we'll have with us presidential aspirant Faisal Mangondato. Mr. Mangondato will join us on Tuesday, March 29th. So if you have any questions, do send them in to ANC Alerts on Twitter and ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Don't forget to use the hashtag ANC In Focus. That'll do it for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit today's episode, you can play back this newscast on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep it here on the news channel.